Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to another program, a program that looks for the positive in some of the most unlikely places. It is my belief that any problem can be improved or mediated on or changed completely if we use different tools, different mindsets. So that's what I've been doing here on this non-commercial station for these many years, trying to provide people with hope. And I believe that in a society that has so much suffering that all the legitimate hope we can offer can be used. And by the way, there are a lot of people who've used this information, because every day when I walk down the streets of any city in the United States, I'm stopped by people who tell stories. They tell the stories of what's happened in their lives. And it's interesting. I was once walking down, just recently, the street with someone who I had just finished counseling. And this is a person who is in a part of a health support group I'm doing just for celebrities. But these celebrities have agreed that if they have made improvements in the conditions that they are trying to make improvements in, that they will go public with it and really try to use their celebrity status to promote the idea that we could be helping save ourselves from all this suffering if we just made simple and really easy lifestyle changes and behavioral changes. So, guy walks up, and we're standing on a corner, and we're walking. And I'd been sitting behind a microphone for about 14 hours doing a whole series of tapes, because when I go out on the road and not always available to do a show when I'm traveling, especially overseas, I have original broadcast ready to go. And so I sometimes counsel people, just all walking, go for a walk and talk. This guy comes up and says, "Hey, saw your movie, liked it," then turns to me and says, "By the way," and then he goes into about a half hour discussion as a school teacher of why he feels that there should be an entire program devoted to helping to understand what constitutes being a teacher in today's society as compared to when he was growing up. He was 45 years old, and he was talking about the nature of the teachers when he was growing up versus the teachers today, and the difficulties that today's teacher has as compared to a teacher teaching in the 40s, 50s, or even 60s. And why there's such an epidemic of false diagnosis and the problems in the classroom and 7 million kids being given prescription medication. It was an interesting dialogue. And that dialogue inspired some thought that we should be doing more, not just with the parents, not to accept these diagnoses and treatments, and the children, not to believe that there's something wrong with them, that's a brain imbalance, but rather examine the entire way that we teach today, and what are the criteria, what are the difficulties, what are the stresses, what kind of position are teachers placed in, and what kind of people are teaching. There's no one universal standard that everyone has to meet. So I will be doing a series of programs on that, using as guests educators and ethicists and philosophers and PTA members and students. In fact, one of the things I'm going to be doing is interviewing about 100 students who have all been diagnosed as suffering from ADHD or ADD, who've all been put on medications, and who all now are off those medications and have no diagnosis of this, and what that means to the large population. And I'm filming this also so that I can show that here are the lives of kids who were stigmatized, irreversibly affected, unless there was an intervention, and there was. So what does that mean about all the other kids? If I can take 100 kids, any 100 kids at random, if you are a psychologist, therapist, a psychiatrist, and you say this kid has got ADHD and ADD and it's not going to change, we just got to keep them medicated to keep them under control, and if I'm able to take 100 of those kids and change 50 of them, or 50%, where you would say not 1% could change, what would that tell you? What would you then do in re-examining your position on this? So I'm going to be spending some time and working on a formula and working on some specific programs for this. So I thank that man for stopping and sharing those thoughts with me. I'm going to take calls today, and today's calls are going to come from the New York City area. Our number is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. So please feel free to call in and share your thoughts. This is a positive forum where we are looking for constructive healing answers. A few thoughts before we go there. This comes from Book Brief, from a review by Mae Won Ho, and it's called Captive State, The Corporate Takeover of Britain by George Monbiot. And I'll quote it. Even though it's about Britain, it's equally true here and actually has been occurring on many different levels here. And it's just something that we don't hear much about or at all. And when we do, it's actually not in the way that this would examine it. But it's almost like the corporate takeover of science. The corporation has taken over virtually every one of the major institutions. And with that, we're getting a different ethic. The corporate takeover is here and threatening the foundations of democratic government. That's the message of George Monbiot's explosive and important book, Corporations Have Seized Control of Our Hospitals, Schools, and Universities. They've infiltrated the government and come to dominate government ministries, buying and selling, planning permission, dispensing our tax money to research and develop that benefit industry, taking over the food chain. To top it all, the British government has colluded in ceding its power to international institutions controlled by corporations, such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. Anyone who is under the delusion that corrupt or corrupted governments are only in third world countries has better think again. The chapter on corporate takeover of universities is too close to home. I've been on the permanent academic staff of the Open University since 1976, but was strongly encouraged to take early retirement last June as I became more and more involved in the genetic engineering debate. In the course of the genetic engineering debate, I had begun to realize that the corporate takeover of science was the greatest threat to democracy and to the survival of our planet. That was why I co-founded the Nonprofit Institute of Science and Society to work for social responsibility and sustainable approaches in sciences and the integration of science and society. As part of that agreement for my retirement, I was to be given an honorary position so I could continue running my foundation from the university while making it clear it was independent from the university. The situation soon began to rapidly deteriorate, however. In August, less than 2 months after my retirement, my research assistant and I were both officially banned from the university campus, Huntington Life Sciences, alleged in a letter and phone call to my head of the department that I was in possession of certain internal papers belonging to them. Huntington Life Sciences is a privately owned laboratory, at the time doing contract research for the biotech companies, among them Imutrin, a subsidiary of the corporate giant Novartis. The university made no attempt to communicate with me or with my assistant before imposing the ban. Had they done so, they would have found that the accusation was false. I was sent some papers by a group campaigning for animal welfare, who were helping me obtain published scientific papers on cross-species organ transplant, the experiments being carried out in the at the university for Imutrin, so that my foundation could prepare a scientific critique, which we did. The internal papers were never used and have been destroyed since, as I judged that there was enough in the scientific literature to damn the whole project on safety and moral grounds. But the chief of HLS, Brian Cass, tried to intimidate me in phone calls and in emails to get me to reveal the identity of the campaigning group. I refused to do so. When I went on campus to prepare my reply to the ban, the sub-dean of science came into my office and threatened to have me removed physically with a security guard. After days on the telephone to my union representative, the dean of sciences agreed to see me. Months later, the ban was lifted for myself, but my assistant, the university denied that she had, in fact, been given an honorary research fellowship a year earlier. I was further barred from using university facilities for my foundation. The animal welfare group, Uncaged Campaigns, has gone public since with a 150-page report leaked to the press documenting excessive suffering of animals at the university and Imutrin's exaggeration of the success of the pig to primate organ transplant research. Imutrin has brought an injunction against Uncaged Campaigns to prevent the release of the report. But just 4 days after the news broke, Novartis, the major parent company, announced the closure of Imutrin and the removal of the research to the United States. Nevertheless, Novartis has pursued the case against Uncaged Campaigns in full trial and won. Since then, there have been a plethora of prominent articles in the mainstream press condemning animal rights activists and defending Huntington Life Sciences. George Monbiot gives many more examples of similar treatments university administrations met out to academics daring to dissent from the corporate agenda or to criticize it. The Center for Human Ecology, started by distinguished evolutionist and geneticist C.H. Waddington more than 30 years ago, was hounded out of Edinburgh University in 1996, essentially for raising questions in both the scientific and popular press about the conservative government's science policies. Academic and government scientists are all too often asked to falsify data in order not to offend corporate funders. Today, there is scarcely a science facility in the United Kingdom whose academic freedom has not been compromised by its funding arrangements. Contact between government-funded researchers and industry, having once been discouraged, is now, in many departments, effectively compulsory. Our universities have been offered for sale, with the result that objectivity and intellectual honesty are becoming surplus to requirements. The sellout began under the conservative government, and with science research funding, which effectively controls what kind of science would be done. In 1993, a white paper on science called Realizing Our Potential intended to produce a better match between publicly funded strategic research and the needs of industry. The research councils, which distribute most of the public money for science, would be obliged to develop more extensive and deeper links with industry. They would be required to recruit more of their senior staff from industry. The Labour government extended those reforms enthusiastically. Its 1998 white paper on competitiveness launched a reach-out fund to encourage universities to work more effectively with business. The role of the higher education funding councils, which provide the core money for universities, was redefined to ensure that higher education is responsive to the needs of business and industry. Thus, it comes as no surprise that the Biotechnology and Biological Sciences Research Council, the main funding body for Britain's academic biologists with an annual budget of over £190 million, is chaired by Peter Doyle, an executive director of the biotech corporation Zeneca. Among the members of its council are the chief executive of the pharmaceutical firm Serescience, the former director of research and development of the food company Nestle's, the president and of Food and Drink Federation, the general manager of Britain's biggest farming business, and a consultant to the biotech industry. This board's strategy contains executives from SmithKline Beecham, Merck Sharp & Dohme, Agrivo, now a subsidiary of Aventis Company, responsible for getting the Department of Environment, Transport, and Regions to support the controversial farm-scale field trials with money of taxpayer. The council has seven special committees, each overseeing the funding of different branches of biology. Employees of Zeneca, the major pharmaceutical company, sit on every one of them. So the British Council, that gives out money, all the money in biological and farm research, established in 1994 to replace a biological program previously run by the Science and Engineering Research Council. Its mandate to advance science of all kinds. The purpose is to sustain a broad base of interdisciplinary research and training to help industry and commerce. Their press release falls into three categories. News about the research grants is allocated, news about the findings resulting from those grants, and fierce attacks on critics and genetic engineering. Arpad Puzetti, a publication in The Lancet, was condemned as irresponsible when Friends of the Earth released the results of research showing that genetic modified oilseed rape pollen was being carried 4.5 kilometers, well beyond the legal isolation distances. The council issued a statement that the finding was, quote, a distraction from the key issues, unquote. Gene biology research is swallowing up the lion's share of the research funds. In January 1999, the council set aside £15 million for new initiative to help British researchers win the race to identify the function of key genes. In July the same year, £19 million, that would be about $25 million, was to be spent on new research facilities to underpin the economic and environmental sustainability of agriculture in Britain through on work exclusively on genetically modified crops. More and more money continues to be poured in. And they're also funding academics to work with corporations to influence the research relevant to the company's objectives. The council launched a biotechnology young entrepreneurial scheme aimed at, quote, encouraging a more entrepreneurial attitude in biosciences, unquote. It was paid for by Nestle, Unilever, GlaxoSmithKline, SmithKline Beecham, AgroEve, DuPont, Rhone, Polink, and Zeneca. Most telling of all, scientists working in university departments receiving any of this grant money are formally gagged to prevent them from becoming, in quote, involved in political controversy in matters affecting research in biotechnology and biological sciences, unquote. In practice, however, scientists can hype biotechnology to their heart's content. The gagging is strictly aimed at critics. The same pattern of corporate takeover is repeated in other research councils, the National Environmental Research Council and the Medical Research Council. I recently visited the Medical Research Council's website and found that an extra £2 billion is to be committed to, quote, health genetics research, unquote, over the next 5 years. That's in addition to the government's projected spending of almost $100 million in university infrastructure through the Science Research Investment Fund, again, for studying genes. The members of the Medical Research Council proposals are controversial, to say the least. Quote, the Medical Research Council proposes human experiments in genetically modified foods, unquote, and the UK population DNA database is to be established. So what we are seeing is there is enormous struggle between the personal individual for freedom and democracy in different spheres of their life and the university and corporate interest believing that they have an economic prerogative to control that. What can we do in the face of ever-increasing consolidation of corporate control? Monobite has only one answer. Don't despair, fight on. He says, the struggle between people and corporations will be the defining battle of the 21st century. If the corporations win, liberal democracy will come to an end. The great social democratic institutions, which have defended the weak against the strong, equality before the law, representative government, democratic accountability, and the sovereignty of parliament, will be toppled. If, on the other hand, the corporate attempt on public life is beaten back, then democracy may reemerge and the stronger for its conquest. But this victory cannot be brokered by our representatives. Democracy will survive only if the people in whose name they govern rescue the state from its captivity, unquote. This book is meticulously researched and scholarly, but despite the seriousness of the subject matter, it is refreshingly well-written. The style of prose is pleasantly evocative, light, and engaging. So, that is something, again, I like to bring to your attention when there is something good out there so people can read it. Now, what's important is that what they're now experiencing in England, France, Belgium, and Germany and Italy, this is old news in America. They have utterly compromised every major university in the United States. Compromised in the sense that when a corporation brings in a large amount of money and says, all right, we're going to give you $25 million and we're going to chair a department in genetic research, the president of the university suddenly sees that, gee, they not only have an immediate cash infusion, but also they'll be participating in profits, which could be into the hundreds of millions of dollars for their percentage. Yeah, there's also the prestige of maybe getting someone who will win a Nobel Prize or some other life science prize for that research. And it gives them another feather in their quill. So that's how they perceive it. But there are the same restrictions, gag orders. You cannot talk about anything that's wrong, even if an experiment that is done has been toxic, killed people, destroyed animals, no matter what the bad effects of an experiment, you can't open your mouth or you can be sued. You cannot control what is done with the research you do if you're a scientist. That is all done by the corporate scientist. They can take mediocre or non-significant findings and turn them into headline news. They have that final authority. They decide who's going to be on the research team, what the research protocols are going to consist of. Quite simply, they have compromised every level of science at the universities. Now, when you already have universities like Harvard and MIT and Stanford, Yale, Princeton, that have historically supported an association with economic interest, not that that is inherently bad, that is not illegal and not necessarily even immoral, depending upon the outcome and how it's developed. But today, that relationship is reversed. The university is nothing more than a rubber stamp for the corporate powers that have the resources and deep pockets, and they're using the university for its pedigree. So the corporate interests clearly control the academic interest, and they've already infiltrated so many areas of government. There was a secret report that I found, and I brought it forward, wrote an article on it, did a broadcast on it. Not a single member of the media picked it up. It was involving the AMA's systematic campaign over a period of several years. This is back in the 1970s they were doing this, to create a computer system. And this is when computers were in their infancy, that would identify every position in government that required medical input. They would then cross-match those requirements with select AMA hardliners. They would get those hardliners in position well in advance, and with their influence over legislative individuals, and they even at that time had targeted a Pennsylvania legislator who was head of a committee that was overseeing all this, and they pulled him out of his campaign debt and financed him, and he was the largest single PAC receiver from the AMA and doctors that year. So they had access. And then they went about filling every single position. Very smart move. What did it mean? What it meant was, let's say that you were a physician and you were using, at that time, the new therapy, chelation therapy. And you believed that it had more than substantiated its ability to help people. So you went to one of the government agencies to see if you could get some funding. Every single time it would come up for review, an AMA person, unidentified as an AMA person, would say no. So no matter where you went, you would have someone from the AMA guarding the gates of every single regulatory and funding agency in the federal government. Let's say that you had you had been a whistleblower and you wanted to reveal information and you thought you would have an open ear to one of the physicians working in one of the government agencies, little did you know that you'd be giving information that would be immediately compromised and used against you. That's one of the reasons why the environmental movement, the health movement, had such an enormous uphill battle, because everywhere you went, the AMA had its people in place. I uncovered this conspiracy, and I had the actual documents, the actual memos, as I had when they conspired against chiropractic, and we won that lawsuit. We won clear to the Supreme Court. They had to settle. But this one did not become a lawsuit, because there was nothing illegal in what they did. It was just questionable in its morality. Filling up every single position with your own supporters would be considered good business today. But the consequences were that people like James Privatira, who was using chelation, was arrested and charged with the crime of offering unscientific medicine and sent to jail. Hard labor. The only thing he ever did was help people with cancer. Every single doctor in America using alternative therapy was harassed. Now, here's something interesting. The Quackbusters are now being sued. A big lawsuit that they had launched, and that they're notorious for launching lawsuits to gag people, was dismissed last week. B, every single Quackbuster that I'm aware of in the United States, with the exception of two, were sued last week in a RICO action. From what I understand, hundreds of people are coming forward now who have been attacked and slandered and libeled and harassed by Quackbusters to provide evidence against them. Hundreds. And there's a very important piece of information that they're going to be needing, and I'm going to provide that. And so there is a time for these people to meet their karma in this lifetime. So I'll keep you abreast of that massive lawsuit. But there was a very important document where one of these Quackbusters actively sought to take over all the files of the AMA when it was having to legally disband Special Department of Investigations, its little Nazi gulag that it had that was used to attack people, innocent people. Well, I have all the memos. I have all the documents of who that person was and their requests. And that will be very interesting when that comes about. So what we have is we have almost every place in America where you go where it requires a physician to give an opinion on the efficacy or safety, you have AMA people. If you've got AMA people, whose interests are the AMA? One of the most utterly vile organizations in American history. Who do they represent? Pharmaceutical industry, lock, stock, and barrel. So what you have is you have the pharmaceutical industry in every place, a position of power. Now we're starting to connect all the dots, and now we can start to show how all this has worked and why we have $2 trillion being spent next year on disease, and why there is no protections in place that do anything that guarantee our safety, and why you cannot any longer trust academic science carte blanche, as at one time we could. That does not mean that all science is corrupt. It is not. Nor are all academic researchers total slaves to the economic dollar. They are not. But I wouldn't wager what percentage of those reports coming out of any academic institution could be trusted. So what is happening in Europe now is no different than when Brundage ran the Olympic Committee for years. What, for almost 40 years? He was the most powerful man in the Olympic. He did one thing. He had a lot of qualities I would absolutely challenge, but he kept it amateur. The moment he resigned, it went professional. Kind of interesting when we look at the Olympics and what it originally meant, which was something very pure and positive, and what it's become. I won't watch the Olympics. I will not. I refuse to. I boycott them. And I'm ashamed of the athletes that compete. I'm ashamed of them because they are, would be like Reggie Jackson going to a Little League game and challenging the four-year-old kid to see who could hit the ball the furthest. It's an embarrassment. The networks that broadcast it, the commentators who report on it, the supporters who prostitute themselves for it, the doped-up athletes, the prima donnas, the princing and prancing, they're an embarrassment. We should never support the Olympics in the current state that it's in, because it has done everything humanly possible to defile and adulterate what its pure and spiritual meanings were. When I saw Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and all these other prima donnas, these go over there and win gold medals against people who were amateurs, people from third world countries, that's not fair. It's not fair on any level because all of our athletes now are supported. It's just one big business. Coca-Cola, the corporate interest of McDonald's, it's their Olympics. It's not the people's. It's not the athletes any longer. And even look at the quality of the athletes who do go there. It's all commercial. It's for the endorsements. Well, if I'm the only person in the world who has found that I will not support something that is utterly corrupted on every level, that's an embarrassment, so be it. Because at some point we have to draw a line in the sand and decide what we will not accept. And there will be a day when a lot of, I believe, teachers and academics and scientists working in academia will stop and pause and say, is it worth it? Especially when they've seen the results of an experiment that was bad and it's covered up. No one will ever know about it, and they can't say anything. And I'm going to wonder how long it's going to take them before they say, this is not what science is supposed to be about. Hey, there was a time that if you did an experiment and the experiment came out wrong, we saw that there was an experiment with wrong. And now you only see what is promising, because there's an economic incentive in what's promising, and there's an economic downside if it's not. And so we have to ask ourselves, when will that day come? What is the tolerance level for integrity bashing at the university level? We've already seen it at the government level, where people will allow the agencies they work for to compromise the truth and integrity constantly and not stand up. Who stood up against Schwarzkopf? Who stood up against Colin Powell? When they made absolute misstatements, one after the other, on Gulf War Syndrome, when they said that there was no proof of the 10,000 false alarms going off on the biological war attacks. Those are all real alarms, not false alarms. Where were all the people who were there? What happened to the logbooks that mysteriously disappeared? Obstruction of justice, if you're a personality within the government, is okay? No. But that doesn't mean that the truth won't eventually come out, because sooner or later, those people who've witnessed all these things, when they feel that they can do so, will do so. It's just difficult when fascism rules in academia, in government, to come forward. You have to be willing to take the hit. You have to be willing to take the sacrifice. And when you see what's done to lesser people, you ask yourself, or greater people, you ask yourself, if you're not as great, will you be able to tolerate it? So right now, please realize that virtually every study that you see published in the newspaper promising some miracle new cure or great improvement or a new vaccine or a new drug, please understand that all of that must be held with suspicion and challenge it until you see the entire story before you see whether it's true, partially true, or false. That does not mean that we will not have positive results or that we should be disdainful. It means that we must be cautious at this point. Caveat emptor, consumer beware, especially in academia. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to the phones and now see what are the issues that you would like to address. Our number, and we're only taking calls today from New York, 212 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. Hi, what's your name, please? You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, good afternoon, Gary Nall. I just had an operation for a tumor, breast tumor, and I refused orthodox methods of chemotherapy, radiation, and tamoxifen. What would be your protocol for something like that?
Okay, well, there's a couple of things I would look at. First, I would like for you to go. Do you have access to the Internet?
Yes, I do.
Okay, right after we hang up, I would like for you to go to GaryNall.com.
Okay.
And then go under Health Issues, Iatrogenic Disease, then Cancer, then Breast Cancer.
Okay.
Did you follow me there?
Yes, I did.
Under Breast Cancer, you will see what no oncologist, no surgeon has seen. You will see every single peer-reviewed literature in English from mainstream orthodox journals. I excluded any journals that were not mainstream or orthodox, and I excluded any that were not well-known. But these are from the National Cancer Institute and the Journal of Oncology and Journal of Reconstructive Surgery. And I show you that their literature, their own studies, that the therapy you're receiving does not work. It's quackery. It's fraudulent. You have been defrauded. You have to find that out for yourself. I've given all the information, just like the therapy that Mayor Giuliani is receiving.
Yes.
It's all wrong. But now, you see, the difference between accepting that it's wrong, not by what I say, I didn't do the research. I didn't write the journals. I didn't publish the articles in mainstream journals. They did. And yet, their oncologist, their chemotherapist are not reading their own literature. If they were, they would never have given you the combination therapy you received because it's not been shown to work. And it's not a matter of arguing. It's not a matter of politics. It's a matter of the arrogance of people not to review their own protocols to see, am I doing the best or not the best? Is something better? But they're not even doing that. I'm not even talking about alternative now. We're just talking about mainstream therapy. Are you clear on what I'm saying?
Yes, I am.
So what I'm saying is that your doctors could be susceptible to malpractice suits, and I believe that class action suits should be brought against all chemotherapists in the United States. You have to understand, however, the chemotherapist is like a Manchurian candidate. Yes, they've got a degree from prestigious universities. Yes, they've had the training. Yes, they have the discipline. But no, they do not have the intellectual flexibility, nor do they have a right brain that has been allowed into that operating room. They're going by cookbook medicine. Here's what everyone else is using. I better use the same thing. If one doesn't work, I'll use Adriamycin. Adriamycin doesn't use, I'll use methotrexate. That doesn't use, I'll use 245. And Floracil, they keep going on and on and on. But it's the same thing. In other words, it's still saying, all right, I've got 22 chemotherapy agents to use. Which of these will work best? Now, that does not mean they're not trying to help you. I definitely believe it isn't. With all their power, they would like to see you well. But the tools they're using are wrong. I could challenge the methods they're using and do. I cannot and challenge their integrity because, as far as I know, they're decent and honorable people. I can challenge the educational system they received as being draconian and overly emphatic on the need to be right and providing certainties so they don't have any doubt that what they're offering you is what they know is the best that they can offer. That has nothing to do with the results. Remember, they're paid whether you live or die. No one's doing anything for free for you. So if you and every other patient they have dies, they're still rewarded as if they had succeeded. Is there something wrong with this scenario?
Yes.
Now, that's number one. So at least you have hard, objective data So it's not, well, who should I believe? Should I believe Gary or should I believe them? And they're at this institution. It's the most famous and they're the biggest and the best and the top and there's 18-foot-high egos and medals to the ground and awards. Who should I believe? Believe the facts. Do you remember what I've said time and again? Don't get caught up in the rhetoric. Look for the truth and look for the truth in the facts. I've given you an opportunity to see the facts. Then make up your mind. Only after you've reviewed the facts. That only answers part of your question. That part of the question that deals with, what should I do? Well, okay, there's two other parts of the question. Second part of the question is, all right, you have this cancer. All right, cancer just didn't happen. Cancer is a process. Cancer is not a disease. It is a symptom. It is a side effect. Now, if you've been taught that cancer is a noun, right?
Yes.
What if I said cancer is a verb? Then when you looked in the mirror, you wouldn't say, I have cancer. You would say, I am cancering, right?
Yes.
Okay. So each day, what do you do that allows your body to cancer? It's like, what do I do to allow my blood to flow, my lungs to inhale, my heart to beat, my mind to think? My emotions to emote. What do I do to allow this process to go forward? It has to be fed. Now, at a certain point, it can take on a life of its own because we don't pay attention to it. We think that somehow it's not a part of it. It's attacked us, but it's not a consequence of our actions. So have you taken the time to examine what consequences have led to you creating this cancer?
Well, I'm a vegetarian. I eat right. I take vitamins. I exercise. I don't eat dairy, wheat, corn, sugar, or none of that. And I just still don't know why I got this cancer.
Okay. What about your emotions?
Well, I guess sometimes I am a kind of emotional person. Sometimes I hold things in when I shouldn't. But other than that,
what about the environment in which you've grown up? Has there been toxins in your environment?
Other than pesticides in the air, none that I can think of.
Okay, well, pesticides cause cancer. Stress causes cancer. Unhappiness causes cancer. An inability to express ourselves can cause cancer. Because all these impact upon the immune system. Remember, if I were to give a scale of what I considered most important in the cause of disease and aging, 10% is diet, 10% is exercise, stress management is about 30%, and 50% is the value of a life honored in how it's lived. So why don't you take a look at that equation and take your time, not now, and see where any of those might have been out of balance, which have caused the process to evolve. I mean, look at how many people are macrobiotics, but they're really unhappy. And look at how many people are involved in any movement and are just miserable human beings. Part of being involved in a movement is rejoicing in the fact that you're committing yourself to something both constructive against something destructive, something that is positive against something that is toxic. But how many people do you see in movements who are toxic and destructive, frequently as much as what they're challenging? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
That's why I don't belong to movements.
Because
Because even though the movement itself can be legitimate, I would rather deal with it in the way that I can without taking on the negative influences of people who live their lives through redeeming it through something that they become involved in their actions in a movement instead of having a life separate from a movement. So we have to look at the broader picture of what might have been done that could have participated in our own death process. And this has to take time. It can't be rushed at. You should sit and reflect on it. If you would like, I'm going to give you a couple titles that can help you in this journey, all right?
All right.
One of the titles is The Baby Boomer's Guide to Getting It Right the Second Time Around. Are you a baby boomer?
Yes, I am.
Okay. The second title is The Guide to a Joyful and Happy Life. Together, it's over 1,200 pages of material that allows you all the exercises that you can reconstruct points in your life that you later adapted your personality to, that in retrospect were not constructive to you. So I'd like you to go through that process. Also, if you were exposed at any time in your life to a toxin, and if your immune system during that period of time was lowered, that toxin, instead of being dealt with and removed from the body, could have been lodged in the body. That then becomes a weak link. Do you know how many people at one time in their life smoked or drank or lived unhealthy lives or took drugs, and now they've been clean, sober, vegetarian, organic, juices, fasting, and boom, they come down with a stroke or a heart attack or cancer, and they say, why me? I've been so diligent. Diligent for how long? Your whole life? Because everything that happens early in life becomes a cumulative effect of that process. Now, was there any time in your life where you were not healthy living?
Probably around 18 or 19 years old.
Okay. Give you an idea. I counseled, in fact, it was yesterday, that I called a person who... I have a group of individuals I'm trying to help who have hepatitis C, that can kill you. Hepatitis C does kill people. People will die this year. Thousands of people have hepatitis C and hepatitis B. These people all have three things in common. A, they never knew they had hepatitis C. B, they were all vegetarians, all took vitamins, all exercised, and all in their 30s. All these people. The biggest difficulty for all of them was accepting how in the world they get hepatitis C. Went far enough back, and two of them had done drugs. But long ago, for a year, one when they were in a relationship back in the mid-1980s, and another in 1984, when they were in high school, for 1 year. Then I explained to him, all it takes is one mistake, and it can stick with you for life. So what happened was that at that time, the body was able to fight the hepatitis, and so the hepatitis set up home. And like so many viruses and bacteria, it can establish a small colony. The immune system is then able to keep it intact. But then later, these people got into relationships and career moves and all kinds of stress, and then chronic stress started to become an acceptable and adapted state of their mind. Whenever there was a problem, they faced the problem, but they faced it with all kinds of trepidation and all the difficulty. And then four of these people were in toxic relationships for a long period of time, and unhappiness. They just didn't wake up in the morning joyful, happy people, happy with themselves and happy with the people they were sharing their life with. What they did not realize is that every moment you spend in a relationship that's not happy, you turn on the immune system and you depress it because you turn on the stress hormones, which attack the immune system. And the immune system, in order to defend itself, becomes hypervigilant. In effect, it's like turning on the sirens that there's a fire, but there is no fire. But your body responds like there is. Could you imagine being awakened every 5 minutes of the night, every night, for a month? You're going to burn out. Well, that's what we do each day. We start to program ourselves to adapt to the toxic people in us. We become, in effect, we become shielded by trying to just accept the energy without allowing it to overwhelm us, but it's at a cost. Where we work, if it doesn't honor who we are. Where we live, if it doesn't honor who we are. Who we're with, if they don't honor who we are. All of those things can impact upon our immune system, and do. the number one cause of disease in the United States is having the wrong attitude and then the wrong values that are not live right and the stress that ensues from that. It is inevitable that you'll get sick. What we don't know is what kind of sick it will be, multiple sclerosis or cancer, a stroke or arthritis. There's no way of knowing that. It really determines what the underlying antigen is in the system that is now going to be no longer held in check but begins to manifest. So when one of these people was undergoing some protocol therapy and was not improving, one thing I ask, well, what did you do? I see you did the medical protocol and some of the nutrition protocol, but what did you do about your unhappy relationship that you were complaining about? What did you do about the work that you couldn't stand? What about all those people that you said you just hated being around because they were so corrupt ethically? Nothing. I see. So you want a healing, and yet 50% to 70% of the equation you've left out. You only did that part that the nutrition and the holistic medical, which represents maybe 30% maximum. Even the juices, the vitamins, everything. That's 30% of the healing process. 70% of all my protocols are non-medical and non-nutritional. They're behavioral. Well, that person to this day has not, in fact, two of them to this day have not done anything about those areas. The others have, and have made remarkable, remarkable improvements. In fact, one of them no longer has hepatitis at all, not even core antigens, surface antigens. Totally normal. Isn't it interesting how this works? Now, because I'm doing this as a study group, I'm keeping meticulous records of following all this because I believe this will be an example of how many other conditions can also be impacted. So the problem is when we start looking at cancer, we look at the tumor. What kind of tumor? Well, medicine wants to make it 210 different types of cancer. And then what will kill the cancer cells? So now they're going to kill the cancer cells and kill other cells as well. And their idea of prevention is tamoxifen, which causes cancer. And are you a woman of color?
Yes, I am.
Are you aware that the literature shows that women of color have a 300% increase in cancer of taking tamoxifen?
Yes, I'm very aware of that.
All right. Well, does it make any sense that if you're a woman of color and you're trying to get over cancer, that they give you something that has a 300% increase in cancer?
No.
All right. Hello?
Yes.
All right. So we have to be aware that we have to use some different tools. Now, what do we need to help the body? All right, get see where I have one. I used to have a screening room, but I don't have one anymore. A little room where people go and watch these documentaries. I have a documentary I've done. And it's a three-hour documentary, and it's called Cancer, A Natural Approach. You may want to take a look at that.
Okay.
Call and speak with the nurse practitioner at the Metropolitan Wellness Center, because they have my cancer protocols over there. That number is 212-252-1942. That's 212-252-1942. That's the second thing you can do. Third thing is start giving yourself time to examine every single thing you do to see is everything you're doing constructive to the ideal self. And if it isn't, at least pay attention to what's not constructive so that then a plan of action can be implemented to change the negatives into positives. Start to spend quality time with yourself and don't any longer look at the cancer as a noun, just a process. And remember, if it's a process, the good news is you can have a healing process take the place of a cancer process. So now everything is going to be meant to implement a healing to the body that will sustain the immune system and by de-stressing. So I want you to go on a de-stressing protocol. There's lots of ways you can do that. But before you choose any of that, take your time, go into any of the bookstores in New York, look under the de-stressing books, take some, sit and read them, make some notes, contact some of the centers, and surround yourself with people who support you in your healing process. De-stressing, reevaluating, detoxifying, deep cell cleansing, and rejuvenation. Those are the five key elements that you can do. Are you clear on all that?
Yes, I am.
All right.
I also picked up your book, Get Healthy Now.
That's got a good chapter on cancer in it.
Okay.
Those are the best therapies I know of, by the way.
Okay.
So you've got all the tools now that you need that you should never have to concern yourself again with cancer. So as of today, let's not even use the word cancer.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
Let's use the word reclaiming life.
I like that.
All right?
Okay.
So let's be positive, not negative.
Of course.
Optimistic. And remember, everyone you surround yourself with should share your optimism for your having the life that you want to live. All right?
All right, Gary. I feel so good now. Thank
good.
You so much.
All right.
Great help.
Everything's going to be fine.
I believe that, as long as I stay positive.
Stay positive and do the right thing to yourself and don't allow anyone else to do the wrong thing.
Never.
All right?
All right.
All the best to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're coming up to the end of a program. And want to thank all the people for listening today. Let me mention that for the people in the tri-state area, especially the advanced support group members, all those who have graduated, I'm giving my lecture this Saturday evening, and we have a ton of people who want to come, and we're filled. If you know that you're not going to be there, please call and release your seat. And not to call and release a seat, you won't be invited back to any others. Now, I've had too many people say, yeah, I'll come, and then they don't, and then someone who would benefit from it can't. So please call Diane at our number in the office and tell her that you won't be able to attend. That would be good of you, because then someone else can use your seat. Have a nice day, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow.